The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney in Zurich right now. David, you've always had an international perspective based on past travels with your dad.
Kevin did start at a young age. I think I started traveling with Don when I was about 4 years old and carrying on the tradition. My oldest son is with me. He's 4 years old. He's been around the world twice already, but this is his first big boy trip with Daddy. We're on our own, and it is different traveling without my wife in tow. This is an interesting experience for all, but he was asking if we could stay in Zurich a few extra days. He seems to enjoy it. Kevin, it's interesting being here, being outside of the United States. It does give one pause, and it causes me to reflect differently on the events that are happening both globally and inside the United States.
Well, David, there seems to be a nervousness building right now, you know, in Europe as well as the world. I mean, just as we speak today, the Dow's off substantially.
Well, every day that goes by, I'm getting more and more nervous. I sometimes feel like I've had one cup of coffee too many,
yeah,
which is not necessarily the case. But, Kevin, I think we are over the brink, and the ramifications of that are soon to be felt. We've got the debt markets, the equity markets, the currency markets, all of which are treacherous. And each time I leave the U.S., I look for positive signs of recovery overseas, or just from a different vantage point, positive signs of recovery in the United States. And unfortunately, I have to say, Kevin, I'm finding the opposite of what I hope for. In fact, there are greater reasons for concern today than in the summer of 2006 or in the summer of 2008, before we began to see the unraveling in the financial markets and in the credit markets, as it were. I say that I'm feeling more nervous because what's happening as time goes on is that we are spending precious time and we're spending national resources on short-term fixes. Really, Kevin, it's in ignorance of the structural reforms needed at the very foundations, both in the area of economics as well as finance and even politics.
Well, let me ask you a question, David. As far as what we're hearing about possibly this being a double-dip recession, I mean, to have a double-dip recession, you actually have to have a recovery. We had a little bit of a recovery in the stock market, but are we going into a double-dip recession or depression at this point?
Let's maybe put some of that in perspective. I want to lean on our friend Bert Doman of the Wellington Letter. In his most recent report, he says, in our view, something much more serious than a double dip has started. We call this the killer wave. It's phase two of the secular crisis. In 2007, we said that there's no chance of a sustainable bottom until at least 2017. Now, Kevin, that is very similar to the analysis of our friend with the CLSA group, Russell Napier, looking for a real bottom in the stock market after 2014 or later.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, this is a problem which continues to evolve. And if you remember the conversation with Napier, our most recent of a series with Russell Napier, he seemed to think that the precipitating event leading to the ultimate decline in the stock market was a sovereign debt crisis. And keep in mind, this is almost a year ago we talked to him, maybe 6 months, but as it were, it wasn't in the news, it wasn't in the headlines. We weren't dealing with the Greek debt crisis at that point. We were on the cusp of it, but it wasn't in the headlines yet. He was ahead of the curve in terms of seeing it as a sovereign debt issue. This is, well, Kevin, there is no double dip. This also from Bert Doman. There is no double dip because there was no recovery. It's just one long decline with a pause and now a resumption of the decline. So, Kevin, is it any surprise that here this May 2010, we have the worst performance in the Dow in any year going back to 1940.
Well, David, and also there seems to be huge credit market fears right now. It just seems like, you know, as far as the rating services, they've been discredited. Moody's was discredited. I mean, there's fear right now in the market, not only to not loan money, but not borrow money. It just doesn't seem like anything's moving right now.
Kevin, if you remember back to some discussions we've had about the European debt markets, as everyone started joining the euro, it was interesting because all those countries basically got the credit rating of the Germans, whether they deserved it or not. And so borrowing costs dropped significantly. As borrowing costs dropped significantly, that caused a real estate boom in a number of different countries. And that's the countries that we've seen with their biggest real estate busts more recently. But borrowing costs then skyrocketed several months ago as each country started being weighed on its own merits. So whether this is Greece or Spain or Italy, we began to see credit default swap spreads, you know, the cost of insuring debt in those markets, we saw them increasing significantly. And then all of a sudden, the solutions, whether it's the $110 billion solution for Greece or the shock and awe solution, 750 billion euro bailout for all the European countries, these things seem to calm down the debt markets, and the cost of insuring against default started to decline. Credit default swaps were getting cheaper and cheaper. Well, guess what? They're back on the rise again.
So basically, the cost of insuring default, basically, insuring against default, the CDS, the credit default swaps, at this point, they're rising again because of the fear that at this point it's not payable.
So in answer to the question, are defaults around the corner, we would have to say, in our opinion, we think so. That if you want to brush off your vocabulary, whether it's restructuring, refinancing, extending, when you change the terms of an original loan agreement, you are in one shape or form or fashion in default, whether you call it default or not. As you listen to CNBC, as you read it in the Wall Street Journal, just understand that regardless of the language they use, we are on the cusp of just that very thing. And so it'll be interesting to see if there are any ramifications. This is one of the interesting things about changing the language of it. Maybe they don't have a quote-unquote technical default and it doesn't cause a trigger in the world of derivatives in terms of paying out on those insurance contracts. But in fact, we will have what we have seen as a repeated theme throughout the bond market history of the last 100 to 200 years, default after default after default after default. One of the surest bets that you can make over an extended period of time is that sovereign entities end up rearranging the original loan agreements, and usually the bond investor pays a very significant and a very painful price.
Well, David, you know, this is sovereign debt that we're talking about, too. This is the supposedly the top level of safety that you can buy when you're buying sovereign debt of a country. I mean, what's going on with junk bonds and municipal bonds and some of those lower levels? I mean, is there a danger there?
Well, in 2008, we saw a credit lockup, and basically no one was extending money, and the credit markets just absolutely froze. Banks are still getting most of their funding on very, very short terms. And so what you have, Kevin, is the structural strains have increased, while at the same time, we've done nothing to fix our rollover risk. We have significant rollover risk with any of your banking institutions. We have significant rollover risk in the junk bond area, and more specifically in the junk bond and municipal bond area, you've got credit risk, which compounds the issue. Kevin, I think junk bonds and munis are on the edge of a cliff. If in 2010 you're sitting on a fat portfolio of junk bonds or municipal bonds, just understand you're going on the equivalent of a diet over the next couple of years. You're going to be losing a little bit of weight. You won't have to worry about having that fat portfolio for much longer.
Well, David, frankly, you're not the only one saying this, and some of the other writers like Doman. I mean, we've got billionaire investor George Soros right now saying we've just entered Act Two of the crisis. And it's based on Europe's fiscal woes and governments pressured to pay back debt that they can't pay. I mean, what is George Soros right now saying, and what's the direction that he's leaning towards?
Well, he was at a conference in Vienna in the last few days, and he said that, quote, the collapse of the financial system as we know it is real, and the crisis is far from over. Indeed, we have just entered Act Two of the drama. So as you were suggesting, Kevin, we're just getting started in terms of this second act. I guess the question is, are we there yet? Is it something that we experience over the next few summer months? The Dow is below 10,000. Does that portend a very ugly July and August and September? Or do we hold things together until this fall? We've got FASB, who wants, that's the Federal Accounting Standard Board, who wants all loans on bank balance sheets marked to market They had pressed for that earlier, and they're back again asking for the same thing. That proposal will be reconsidered in September. And you might ask, well, is that what could be a trigger for an October collapse? October is notoriously an awful month for the stock market. You know, what is it that causes us to sort of keel over in the market, as it were?
So are you saying, David, in October or sometime this fall, we could possibly at some point break the March of 2009 lows that we had on the stock market, those incredible crash days that people thought we would never get down to?
You know, Kevin, to me, it's not a question of if, but when. We are going to retest those lows. The chart patterns, if you look at the 1929, 30, 31, and 32 period, are identical to what we have today. We saw a significant collapse in 29, and then over a 50% cyclical recovery before we saw that nasty, nasty period, 1930 to 32, where the stock market finally washed out. And I think we're in the process of seeing something very similar to that. We saw a nasty decline on the S&P to below 670 points. And we've seen over a 55% recovery, a cyclical recovery, in the context of a structural or secular bear market. And I think we're likely to see, whether it's 2010 or 2011, moving in that direction to new lows, fresh lows, lower lows. And I think that's going to be devastating for the middle class because, quite frankly, Kevin, it is the average investor who is being suckered into this market. With good statistics that are being fabricated by the government in terms of GDP, although 2.7 is below the estimated 3% growth, still Wall Street is heralding any growth as positive and is trying to bring in the common man into this marketplace.
Well, what's interesting too, David, is you're not seeing consumption go up. I mean, one of the key indicators that you watch, and I don't think a lot of people watch this, but one of the key indicators that you watch is container freight rates. I mean, that sort of shows how much people are consuming and how much is being distributed. What's going on with the container freight rates right now?
Going back to 2008, Kevin, we watched the Baltic Dry collapse, the Baltic Dry Index, and that is one measure. Other measures of container freights, you know, also indicate that world trade really has not picked up. We're at the bottom in terms of rates, and you would begin to see a recovery there if, in fact, there was more and more shipments coming from, whether it's, you know, Indonesia, Malaysia, Taiwan, South Korea, not just China, but throughout the Asian and developing world to Europe and to America, to the United States. And it's just not happening, Kevin. The container and freight rates are flat on their backs.
So while consumption has been dropping, we've just been raising the U.S. deficit. It's topping, it's like 12 or 13 trillion at this point, isn't it?
Well, yeah, according to the Treasury Department report to Congress earlier this month on June 9th, the total of U.S. deficits will be 13.6 trillion just this year. By 2015, it'll climb to an estimated 19.6 trillion. So, yeah, I mean, we've got a picture that is frankly going from bad to worse. And again, I think the frustrating thing and what gives me that nervous feeling, Kevin, is that we're still treating this as if we were in the midst of a credit boom. I mean, we're still talking about the idea of a jobless recovery, which has happened in the past, but happened in the context of credit expansion, not credit collapse, not credit contraction. We're at the end of a 30-year credit expansion, Kevin, and you cannot have recovery without people employed and people going to the tills and spending money, parting with hard-earned cash, or as it were, putting it on a credit card.
Yeah.
Their credit limits have been limited, and they can't do what the mandarins in Washington are expecting them to do, hoping that they're doing, crossing their fingers, and just, you know, again, buying time. If we can just buy time, that's kind of the mantra in Washington, then things will heal themselves, when in fact, it's not happening.
In fact, David, not only is it not happening, but real M3, which the government stopped publishing a couple of years ago, and we talked about, but is still registered with Shadow Statistics, John Williams, real M3 is collapsing. It's down 7.8% annualized. How in the world can we be having any kind of recovery if the broad money index is collapsing at that rate?
You know, it's interesting. The last time I saw that number, it was 6% annualized, and then the most recent 7.8%. So it's not as if things are increasing. In fact, the trend is getting worse in terms of a collapse in M3. This kind of a collapse, Kevin, is actually worse than what we saw in the 1930s in the midst of a deflationary depression. What you do have is an unprecedented amount of liquidity creation on the other side, probably not enough, But the at least to do what they want to do, which is prop up the system, you see the adjusted monetary base continue to explode higher. We've looked at those charts repeatedly over the last few years, and that is liquidity, which, frankly, they're asking to fill an infinite void. How much debt and bad debts have been created over the last 20 to 30 years? How many of those debts need to be liquidated? And to what extent is the liquidity being created by the Fed and Treasury sufficient to fill that void? If the void is infinite, there's nothing that they can do, and we're stuck in a conversation between inflation and deflation where you've got strong indications of both. How much will it take to fill the void? Is it even possible? These are things that we're going to have to see. Certainly, you see in the commodities complex signs of deflation. The one exception, the one exceptional standout is gold, where it's being treated as a currency, where you look at the balance sheet of the U.S., you look at the balance sheet of any other sovereign entity around the world, and people say, no, we're not interested, we don't like the paper, we don't like the debt obligations, we think that ultimately we're going to be at the wrong end of that bet, being at the end of that IOU, and guess what? They're looking at gold in a very different way, as a currency, not a commodity. But if you look at the general commodities complex, including oil, it's half of its peak.
Mm-hmm.
Platinum, half of its peak. Palladium, a little bit better. Silver, not at its peak, but getting closer every day. There is a disjunction, if you're looking at the commodities, between the inflation-deflation debate. Well, where we can say that there is still an utter dismantling, Kevin, and a complete collapse, is in the housing numbers. The housing numbers this last month were awful. U.S. home foreclosures hit a record in May, up 44% from a year ago. Kevin, that's not a road to recovery, I can tell you that much. These guys are smoking good grass if they think that that represents recovery.
Yeah, well, David, you know, we've talked about how the Federal Reserve feels like they can control everything. Right now, they've been printing so much money, just an amazing amount, but it's just sitting in the form of excess reserves. You know, we've talked in the past, or you've brought up in the past, how hyperinflation doesn't happen just slowly. What happens with hyperinflation is you go through deflation as all this excess liquidity builds up like water behind a dam, and then the dam breaks. Now, what's the Federal Reserve saying? We were talking last week in the program that there was going to be a Federal Open Market Committee meeting and an announcement. I mean, what is the Federal Reserve saying to address this issue?
Well, it was more pessimistic than expected. And, you know, this is what they said in quotes, financial conditions have been less supportive of economic growth on balance, largely reflecting developments abroad. And, Kevin, this is what gets a little bit absurd, and it's one of the reasons why I do enjoy traveling and interacting with investment professionals all over the world, because the FOMC communique, which blames imbalances in the U.S. and a less supportive economic growth environment on the rest of the world and developments abroad, I mean, specifically, they're talking about Europe.
Mm-hmm.
That really is a little bit crazy, because when you look at the debt to GDP numbers and the projections from the Bank of International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, the numbers in the UK and the numbers in the US are actually far worse than what you have in the Southern European countries, which have been called the pigs of late.
Mm-hmm.
So this is where the hypocrisy really lies, Kevin. It's the Federal Reserve saying it's someone else's fault, just as Greenspan said he had nothing to do with this problem. And Bernanke will say the same when he retires. And the guys at the Fed and the FOMC, as they put their heads together, they still want to blame someone else, you know, largely reflecting developments abroad. I mean, give me a break. There is a strategy in play. I don't think it's one that will work, but there's a strategy in play to bring Greece's imbalances back to 3%. From 12 to 13, you know, within 5 years. There is no way we can do the same in the United States or in Great Britain by 2040. This is what's interesting, looking actually at a different set of statistics. By 2040, gross domestic product and our debt levels in ratio, what percentage is one of the other, the UK is expected to be well above 500%. This is, again, according to the Bank of International Settlements. The US is going to be above 400%. Of GDP, debt to GDP. The most recent study by Reinhardt and Rogoff was that things get very cattywampus and unstable above 90%. This year, we're 93. Next year, they estimate we're going to be 115. And that strips out the obligations of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, assuming that those aren't our own balance sheet liabilities. And it also strips out any of the municipal liabilities that get thrown onto the federal balance sheet this year, which I think we'll see, whether it's Illinois or Arizona or Florida or California, I mean, which is the first of many shoes to drop. Kevin, again, this is the hypocrisy of the day in which we live, And you don't really see it or feel it, or in this case, hear about it until you go overseas. And then, you know, money managers in Switzerland or Germany or the UK say, hey, wait a minute. Actually, the U.S. has its own set of problems, don't they? And what are they doing to fix their problems? Is there anything that they're not telling us, things that they're doing behind the scenes that are improving the picture? And I have to just shake my head and say, unfortunately, they're just not that creative. We're doing the old, tried, and tested Keynesian, which we've seen as failures and will continue to over the next few years.
Well, David, debt to GDP ratios are one thing, but what about tax revenues?
Well, that's a bigger issue, and this is something that Neil Ferguson has pointed out on a number of occasions. This is where you reach a point of real criticality. The U.S. has already gone from 7% of its tax revenues going to service the national debt. Again, this is servicing the national debt, the interest payments,
right,
to 20%. We've already migrated pretty far from 7 to 20, and over the next three decades, if we don't see dramatic cuts in spending, 100% of our tax revenues are going to be servicing the national debt. And obviously, that's not sustainable.
Right.
So, Kevin, as I mentioned earlier, this is where being a Treasury investor, if you're buying U.S. or U.K. bonds, 50 out of the last 100 years, if you were buying Treasury paper or government paper, you lost, and you lost big. 50 out of the last 100 years, you did all right. But here we are ending two decades where the biggest gainers were for Treasury investors. And I have to be quite honest, I doubt very seriously that the next 10 years are going to be pleasant for a U.S. or U.K. bond investor. The numbers just don't work.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. Don't forget to join us. David will be speaking in Las Vegas July 7th through the 11th, in Denver July the 24th, in San Francisco, August 19th through the 21st, and in New Orleans, October 27th through the 30th. For more information, give us a call at 800-525-9556. Ask for Karis, and she'll give you the details. David, you know, we've talked before about all the world leaders meeting, trying to figure this out. As you know, strangely enough, you were in Switzerland last year when the big G20 meeting was first convening. The G20, of course, the news this week was G20 convened, and I have to think this is a little bit like Humpty Dumpty, where all the king's horses and all the king's men, they're meeting, but they're not putting anything together again, you know? I mean, what occurred at the G20 that makes anything different than what it was before it convened?
Well, two things. I would like to quote Mohammed Alarian from PIMCO and also the German finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble, both of whom stated their opinions in the Financial Times, were there at the meetings, and had this to say. Alarian, the world is facing deep structural challenges, yet its leaders are stuck in a short-term cyclical mindset. I mean, honestly, Kevin, that says it all right there.
Right.
But he goes on to say, until they break out of it, we'll see little more than fruitless discussions, national policy flip-flops, and a troubling lack of global policy harmonization. Without action, our future will be disappointing global growth and periodic sovereign debt crises. Let us hope this, if nothing else, is enough to bring the two camps together.
And that's from PIMCO. That's Alarian from PIMCO?
That's correct. The two camps that he's talking about are what Wolfgang Schäuble was getting at in his article in the Financial Times. He was quoted as saying, to the question of what caused the recent turmoil in the Eurozone, there is one simple answer: excessive budget deficits in many European countries. It comes, therefore, as a surprise to me, at least, that one of the most passionately debated economic issues of the day should be whether Germany is acting prematurely in reining in its deficits and thereby choking the rebound at home in our neighbors, in our neighbors' markets. My response is an emphatic no. And then later in the article, Schäuble says, behind the calls for us to pursue a more expansionary fiscal course lies two different approaches to economic policymaking on each side of the Atlantic. While the U.S. policymakers like to focus on short-term corrective measures, we take the longer view and are therefore more preoccupied with the implications of excessive deficits and the dangers of high inflation. This defines the two camps. We've got the U.S. camp, which is very focused on a short-term fix, and we've got the rest of the world, including Europe, saying, no, there actually is something structurally wrong. Fascinating to watch our leader in the U.S., Obama, try to throw his weight around, but to no avail. In this case, there was a sound, no, we're not interested in your opinion at this particular meeting.
There seems to be a real clash right now in the news between austerity, like what you're talking about in Germany, and just unbounded spending, which is the Keynesian approach here in America. I mean, which one's going to win, and is that conflict actually going to turn into a deeper depression?
Well, as Ilarion said, there is no global policy harmonization at this point. The G20 ended where it began, with divided interests and divided strategies on the one hand, focused on austerity, and then on our side of the pond, profligate spending, specifically in the U.S. Many parts of Europe, Kevin, see the current debt numbers as unsustainable, as we were talking about just a few minutes ago, and they look at future numbers not only as unsustainable, but as devastating. And it's just a difference in perspective. The U.S. sees no problem with current or future numbers unless we fail to spend more and increase our indebtedness more at this particular juncture. So you've got Krugman and the whole Keynesian lot, now that Peter Orszag has retired or is in the process of retiring, there's only the Keynesian cadre speaking into the president's ear. What do we have ahead? We have exactly what Schauble said. They're concerned that our deficits will be unsustainable, and they don't want theirs to follow. And they're concerned about the dangers of high inflation.
David, let me ask you a question. Why has no one looked at the 1921 solution, where debt was actually cut and a recovery came very quickly?
Kevin, that's a very good question, but they took official unemployment from 12% to 4% within 2 years.
That was in 1921.
For us to move from 10% to 8% between now and 2020, so 10 years from now, Kevin, yeah, they went from 12% official unemployment to 4% within 2 years. And as you said, because of dramatic budget cuts, in fact, they cut the budget in half. So by 1922, 1923, 1924, not only was the economy recovering from a nasty deflationary collapse, but guess what? We don't think of the 1920s as a depressionary era, even though it started out that way. We think of the 20s as the roaring 20s.
All right.
Well, hello. It was just a different set of ideas that went into place. For us to drop from 10% to 8%, we'd have to add 300,000 jobs a month, and it'd take 10 years for us to get there. We have a hard road ahead, particularly since we're not willing to do what is politically difficult to do. And I say politically difficult because nobody wants to cut their pet projects. That's what's required. We need a set of statesmen, Kevin. We need a set of statesmen with a set of you-know-whats in Washington doing the right thing right now, and they're not willing to. That's the biggest problem. We have political interests in the middle of an economic catastrophe, and they're not willing to put the interests of the nation in front of their own legacy. This is a disaster.
Well, David, we mentioned the Bank of International Settlements earlier. What did they have to say about G20?
This morning, Kevin, with the G20 being fresh in everyone's mind, they're commenting on several points. They're highly critical that, one, interest rates are too low and need to be raised. That, number two, banks are way too dependent on central bank funding, which has allowed for very high leverage to remain with individual institutions. Of course, they've commented on a lot of different things, but these are the highlights that stood out to me. Lastly, I note that the Bank of International Settlements is very direct about the terms most banks function on. Again, I mentioned this a few minutes ago, it's on very short-term funding, which leaves them very vulnerable to a liquidity crisis and extreme rollover risk. We are on the doorstep of another 2008 credit freeze because none of the banks have changed the terms of their loans. A lot of corporate interest and commercial paper, short-term financing at the corporate level, has been extended from 3, 6, 9-month terms to 1, 2, and 3-year terms, Kevin. So your corporations have gotten smart. CFOs, COOs, CEOs, their board members have gotten together and said, these are real problems. We don't want to get hung out in the credit markets again. But banking institutions have done nothing, Kevin. And the Bank of International Settlements has been keen on pointing that out.
Well, as far as our advisory team in Washington, I mean, it's just all Keynesian across the board, right? So the only solution that they're going to come up with is continuing to print money and try to push a string that's not moving.
Well, and keep interest rates low. I mean, it's with Peter Orszag leaving, you know, with the Bank of International Settlements' criticism of interest rates being too low, good luck seeing that change in the United States, unless it's the bond market and the bond market vigilantes starting to push rates up. But it's not going to come from the Fed.
Well, David, it seems here at home the crisis of the moment is financial regulatory reform doesn't have the votes right now that it takes to get it passed.
And that's going to take probably more negotiation. It means to go back to the drawing boards with a couple of the key points. Maybe it won't end up being as egregious as it was yesterday or the day before. Goldman's most recent estimates put the cost of the reform to banks. If you're a regional bank, it's going to cost you 5% out of earnings. And if you're one of the big banks, it's going to cost you as much as 13% out of earnings. And before you shed a tear for the banks, you just need to remember that when they're squeezed, it's actually you that's getting squeezed. Don't let your sense of justice, you know, well up within you as a listener and say, yeah, well, they're going to pay the price. No, actually, you're going to pay the price. It means that your interest income is going to remain low even as rates rise, or if they should rise. The difference, the spread, is going to be going to the bank balance sheet to compensate for that 5 to 13% loss. The bank levy, this is a part, it came at the very end of the financial regulatory reform. This bank levy, which is going to raise an extra $18 billion. Again, that's $18 billion that could have been interest income to you, the investor. And it ends up being essentially a pass-through. The levy is a pass-through to the investment community, and we continue to have a hard time with meeting the income needs. So it continues to put pressure on savers who require income from their assets.
You know, David, one of the key indicators that the banks pass the cost back over to us is mortgage rates. You know, right now the Federal Reserve is almost giving the banks money for free, yet mortgage rates really aren't much lower. I mean, they're low, but they're not nearly as low as they could be at this point, you know, to pass those savings on to the person who's actually buying a house.
If they were tracking the benchmark treasuries, Kevin, they would be about 70 basis points lower, so almost 1% lower. Now, they are at all-time lows, less than 5%, or at recent lows anyways. And, you know, so they are low. I'm not complaining. Neither should anyone be if they're financing their debt at these rates. But as you say, Kevin, there is a disconnect in the market. The relationship to treasuries, Kevin, the differential is more like 20 basis points, and it's now like 90. So there's about 70 basis points difference between what normal and the current rates are. So mortgage rates don't really reflect the rates that banks are getting from the Fed and Treasury. So what do we see the banks doing? They are going to, as they have over the last 18 months, repaired their balance sheets with every dime they possibly can. That does mean that the lending cycle and the multiplication effect of a fractional reserve banking system remains broken. Lending is not occurring where it needs to.
David, we had talked about the incredible increase in foreclosures. How is that affecting Fannie Mae and Freddie right now?
You know, the only thing I can say, Kevin, is that as I look at the financial regulatory reform, the areas that are just patently absurd, you know, we know now, and everyone knows now, the complication and the deceit that went into the rating agencies putting a AAA sticker on stuff that just stunk to high heaven, junk quality stuff that got a AAA sticker. You realize the rating agencies basically get a free pass in this financial regulatory reform. So you got to ask, what do these guys want? What is this about? This has to be nothing but a power grab, because it certainly is not getting to the heart of the issue. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they get a free pass. I mean, come on. This is the center of the real estate debacle. Structured and securitized mortgages, and there's nothing coming down to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, a limitation of lending, a requirement of 5% or more down. I mean, come on, Kevin, if we wanted real reform, we could get it, but we don't. And that's where I think we need to show up in the polls in November. And where we don't get real reform legislatively, we need to throw them all out. I think, Kevin, this is what we're seeing, and I just want to end with a few comments on gold. What we're seeing in the marketplace is frustration. We're seeing people lose confidence in their leadership. This is when people begin to say, I don't know what to do. You know, normally I'd go to treasuries. Normally I'd sit in cash or CDs. Right. You know, I look at my conservative investment alternatives. An average investor says this to themselves, and they look and say, you know, just the system doesn't seem right. There's something about the whole thing. It seems like the game is fixed. And if it means it's a lose-lose for me, then I'm just going to opt out. And that's what we're seeing on a global basis, because people don't like what they see from the Swiss National Bank. They don't like what they see in Great Britain. They don't like what they see with the ECB. They don't like what they see with the Fed. They're virtually all playing by the same playbook. The ECB is trying their best to introduce new measures, austerity measures, but it's a broken system, Kevin. Confidence is the broken part of the system, which needs repair, and we're not seeing any efforts by the mandarins on Wall Street or Washington to repair what is broken. We'll continue to see a significant move into gold by institutions, by the world's wealthy, and ultimately by the common man as he figures out that he's been played, that his confidence has been played, he's been lied to, he's been manipulated, and his only chance of survival is to opt out. He'll come late to the market, it's not too late now. Given another 2 or 3 years, I think it's going to be pretty late. We'll have to see. But I think, Kevin, that's what you see in the price of gold. It's not an increase in the commodity price. It's a decrease in confidence globally in our decision makers.
So as long as confidence is dropping in all the other systems, gold will probably be rising.
I would encourage any investor who has a position in gold simply to stay the course. Personally, I'm more confident in a strong gold strategy with every passing day. Looking for an exit strategy in the long run is certainly important, but recognizing that there is no better place to be in the short run is imperative. I would absolutely stay the course.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.